we have a good number present this morning. Let me welcome everyone who's here. I know we have visitors. We're glad you're here, and I hope we make you feel welcome and you'll want to come back and be with us often. If you've not filled out a visitor's card, you should be able to locate one just in front of you, and we'd like for you to do that. Appreciate it if you will. Beautiful Sunday morning, and I need to really make an announcement before I begin the lesson this morning, because a day that we probably thought might not ever come has finally come. Our brother Wes Gossett and Rachel were married this week, and Rachel, all I can say is you must be a very special woman. After all those comments that were made even up here publicly. But no, we extend our congratulations to Wes and Rachel and pray that God will bless them in their new unity together. Good to see everybody. And this morning, we're going to, as I have been announcing, we're going to kind of shift our attention to the book of 1 Corinthians as we close out this section of our theme in which we're talking about going to church, obviously. And we've been talking about our assembling together. Now, that doesn't mean we won't mention that idea, but we're going to transition into the idea of what we do in worshiping. But as we close this section out and kind of tie a lot of things together, I want us to take a look at the church at Corinth. Paul has quite a bit to say about their assembling together. In fact, uses the phrase, when you come together, or you come together in the assembly, etc., more than we see anywhere else in the New Testament. So we'll focus our attention on that. But as we get into talking about that, let's take note of the church at Corinth. Because while on his very next missionary journey, in other words, a short amount of time, troubling news reached Paul of the church that he had just established not long before, just really probably months before, a year or so, that he had established at Corinth. And it was reported to him by those of the household, the family of Chloe, that there were members of the church who, really a number of disturbing things. And let's just kind of run through a list. The household of Chloe reported that these members at Corinth were already divided over which teacher to follow. Obviously, Paul had come there. Apollos had come behind him. The apostle Peter had come there. And at least those three, these given to a Greek tradition of clamoring toward a particular teacher and his teaching, were deciding which of the men to follow. Chloe's household also reported that even though they had come out of immorality, so many members there remained immoral. One brother even had his own father's wife. And as chapter 6 tells us, fornication was rampant within the church. They went to court to settle their disputes with each other. And Paul found that particularly disturbing. Can't you settle these things between yourselves, he said. In fact, they even defrauded or cheated their spouses. And this may be the opposite of the idea of fornication, where some were buying into a Grecian, old Grecian philosophy, the idea that everything physical is just bad, it's evil. Even the relationship between husband and wife. And so they were dishonoring their marriage vows. Some were even divorcing, as it appears in chapter 7. They had an inordinate attachment, that is, an out-of-place view of idols still, and the sacrifices made to them. And some would purchase, you know, meat that had been sacrificed. But they were wounding the conscience of their brother, perhaps their weaker brother, one who didn't have understanding, but without regard for his conscience, what he felt, what he believed, what he sincerely thought was wrong, etc. They didn't care. They just, without regard, didn't consider their brother's conscience. They were not respecting the proper roles of men and women. We see that in chapter 11. And we also see it again in chapter 14 as he describes the assembly itself. We'll get back into that idea. They abused the Lord's Supper of all things. They had come to really abuse it. We'll talk about that as we get later into the summer and we're talking about worship and so forth. we'll take a close look at chapter 11 and what was going on. And we'll interpolate a passage from the book of Jude, actually, in talking about that. But they had spiritual gifts. And yet, even though they had all of these wide range of spiritual gifts, be they healing or prophecy or, you know, word of knowledge or whatever it might be, some had the ability to speak in a foreign language, and that was the gift they coveted. That was something they thought they wanted, and regardless of their own blessing of a spiritual gift, that didn't matter. If they didn't have the gift of speaking in tongues or speaking in another language, that's what they wanted. And finally, strangely, for any Christian, whether it was back then or it's today, because there are those today who do the same thing, they had lost faith in the ultimate or final resurrection on Judgment Day. And so Paul really basically says, what's the point then of what we do? Now, if you look at that law, and there are other problems. I just selected these as a list to make the point. Here Paul receives this report. This church has a lot of problems. In fact, many people are well aware of that. And if you were to ask probably any Bible student, you don't have to be a, you know, a really deep Bible student, but if you were to say of all the churches in the New Testament, which one would you think has the most problems? Most people, if they're familiar with the New Testament, will readily say Corinth. Paul said to these people, I show you a more excellent way than all of this. Regardless of what your particular problem is, regardless of what you're doing, there's a more excellent way, and obviously it's the way of Jesus Christ, and that's what Paul had to say to them. Let's continue to look at the assembly at Corinth, and it may surprise you that I would say this. In many ways, Corinth was very typical. Now you might find that strange. With all that list of problems and that not even being an exhaustive list, how in the world or why in the world would I say Corinth is very typical? Because of it. I believe in any church, and I've been around a while, you know, so I think that in any church, and I believe this is the case, in any church there are advantages. We can look at this congregation, for example, and we have a lot of advantages. Look around you. We're not three or four people gathering this morning, maybe in someone's house, maybe in a storefront or whatever. We're very blessed. We've come out this morning and we're better than 100 strong, and we are each Lord's Day morning. We gather in a nice building, a nice facility to worship the Lord. But that's not the only advantage we have. Look around you. We have people from newborns all the way up to nearly 100 years old. We have a good mixture of people of all ages. We have many children here. Many churches across this land and even around the world would practically give about anything to have the opportunity with all of the children we have. We have a diversity here that's unlike most congregations. People from different ethnic backgrounds, etc. I like to say from all the major food groups, we have them, you know. We have a lot of advantages here. We're not a poor, struggling congregation. We're not a hungry congregation in the sense of we don't have the basic needs or staples of life. We're not struggling to get them. In fact, we're very blessed. We have a lot of advantages, a lot of strengths, but we also have our challenges, just like Corinth had. And we can sit down and enumerate them. We can talk about what we need to do better. We can talk about our weaknesses, where we need to be strengthened, etc. Corinth was very typical. Because just like Corinth, members encounter problems. And that is always the case in any congregation. I've never known one that was an exception to members having problems, be that doctrinal and or moral, at any given point in time in the life of a congregation. And there are always threats to a church, whether they come from without, outside these walls, but usually they also come from within. At any given point in time, that's where a church is, that's what a church is facing. And so I say again, Corinth was very typical. Even though it seems to stand out to us as being a church filled with problems unlike all the others, I think a deeper view would show that no, Corinth was very typical in the first century and very typical when compared to churches today. Brethren, Paul said this, and you may want to turn to 1 Corinthians 13. That's where the bulk of this lesson is going to come from. So having said to those Corinthians, something I will come back to very soon in a lesson. Having said to those Corinthians who were wanting, all of them wanting to speak in another language and had that special ability and coveting what someone else could do and all of that kind of, to them, Paul said, covet the best gifts. Look at the very end of chapter 12. Covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. Now going into chapter 13, here's how Paul opens. Paul said to them, and he makes it personal to himself, I could so and so, but the truth is applied to any of us. You can have talents, abilities, and in their case, Paul is specifically referring to, for the most part, spiritual gifts. In ours, we might compare that to natural talents and abilities, whether we've acquired them or we were born with them. But you can have all those talents and abilities, Paul says in verse 1, but without love, it's just noise. Doesn't mean anything. Paul goes on to say in verse 2, you can have prophecy. You can understand everything. You can gain all knowledge and all faith, but without love, you're nothing. And you know, in the Lord's church, one of the greatest problems that I've seen in 42 years, one of the greatest problems I've seen is that we're right about so much. And you might say, that's not a problem. Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Go back and look at chapter 8 and verse 1 in 1 Corinthians. And one of the things that Paul will tell you, one of the things he will warn those brethren who didn't care for their weaker brother's conscience is, knowledge puffs up. It's a natural tendency of a human being when they are right. I know I'm right. It's a natural tendency to be filled with pride because of that. And what happens in the Lord's church, and I think verse 2 is descriptive of any Christian, and more so as they gain knowledge. I know what you don't know. And Paul said, though you have prophecy, you understand everything. Now, I don't think I understand everything. But I think I understand a lot more than I did 42 years ago. But Paul said, though you have all knowledge and all faith, if you don't have love tempering that, you're nothing. You are nothing. One of the greatest threats to a church is the more they grow, not the less. The more they grow in knowledge, the more they come to understand where they begin to bicker with each other, fight with each other, concentrate so much on doctrine, they forget they're supposed to love each other. And that's descriptive of way too many churches of Christ. Paul says in verse 3, you can be charitable. And I believe he speaks here of giving away things, you know, giving your money, etc. I think you look up on the board, we're a giving congregation. You can be charitable. You can even be sacrificial. And you know, when you give, you feel good. It's better to give than to receive. You feel good about giving gifts. Honestly, if you're a giving person, you're disposed to giving, and we should be. There is just a natural blessing that comes from that. You feel good about it. You like it. And there's nothing wrong with that, except if you get carried away with how much you're able to give. And so Paul said, you can be charitable, you can even be sacrificial, but without love it profits you nothing. And you see, as he opens this to these brethren, what he is saying to them is to reflect back on something Jesus said in John 13, brethren, love one another. Don't fight and bicker with one another. Don't get carried away about who's right and who's more right. And don't get carried away with how much you do or how much you know. Love each other. Because like Jesus said the night before he went to the cross, that's what distinguishes you as my disciple. That's what marks a Christian. When you look at someone who is loving, someone who loves their brother, and that is the first order of business, if you will, then you know there is something in that person that reflects Jesus Christ. In fact, I like to call this the rule of love. We speak a lot today, and people speak a lot today, about the rule of law. As people in this country fight, and it gets uglier and uglier and uglier, they scream at the top of their lungs, the rule of law, rule of law, rule of law. And for Christians, there ought to be the rule of love. Every time one of us speaks in a class, every time one of us walks up into this pulpit, I need to think about, before I preach a sermon, am I being guided by the rule of love? As I talk to you, you talk to me, as we treat each other, however we treat each other, as we greet one another, as we have conversations, as we engage with one another on a daily basis, am I ruled by the love of Jesus Christ? And if there is anything else in my mind, anything, whether it is how much talent and ability I have, how much I know that you don't, how right I am, how much better I am than you because of how much I give, if that's what's guiding me and ruling me, I've lost the rule of love. I'm not reflecting Jesus Christ. Because Jesus, you know, the scribe came up to ask him, to tempt him on Tuesday, I suppose that it is, before he was crucified on Friday, and said, "Master, what is the great commandment?" But they knew it already. I think if you look back at Luke 10, and I won't take time to do that this morning, but if you were to look back at Luke 10, you can see the scribes were well aware that these two points Jesus is going to make is exactly what you are supposed to say. What's the greatest commandment? Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, didn't he say? Love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, Jesus would say, there is no other commandment greater than these. In other words, when you began to look at the idea of love your neighbor as yourself, when you began to think in terms of how we engage with one another, how we treat each other, even what we say, even what we preach, love one another should be the overriding, overruling commandment. No commandment is greater than these. Now, I might be carried away with some particular thing. And I might look at myself in some way as being superior to you. Maybe it's one of those three points that I just looked at from 1 Corinthians 13. But if love is not the overruling thought in everything I do, no commandment is greater than these. In fact, so much so that James, writing probably what is the first book of the New Testament to be written, would say in James chapter 2 and verse 8, it is the royal law of Scripture, or according to Scripture. Think about that for a moment. What law, just like the scribe was saying to Jesus, of all the commandments, all the ordinances of God, and there are many, there were many from the Old Testament. Some have counted and said over 600. So what's the greatest of these? What would you say you can look at and say that's the supreme law? Jesus said, love God, love your neighbor. No commandment is greater than these. And so, what law would we choose? What would we say is the sovereign law? That's what the word royal means. The ruling law. Love your neighbor as yourself. When it comes to how we treat each other. You think about that, and you realize that Paul doesn't just, we talk about 1 Corinthians 13, and we say Paul, you know, writes the great chapter on love. The truth is, Paul had a lot to say about love. Paul's epistles are ripe with the teaching the Corinthians needed. And if they would look at the teaching just of Paul. I mean, you could look at other writers in the New Testament as well. But if you look at what Paul has to say, think of some of the things Paul teaches. Go with me to Galatians 5 for a moment. What's going on in the churches of Galatia? Now, this would be earlier. You know, maybe 7-8 years before Corinth had its problems. But what was going on in the churches of Galatia is not so much the immorality that Corinth had. But it was the teaching. They had become divided. They were doctrinally fighting with each other. And so Paul writes to them, and listen to these words in Galatians 5. Down in verse 6, he says this. And this is interesting to me. In Jesus Christ, neither circumcision profits anything, nor uncircumcision. I want you to think about that for a moment. One of the great doctrinal divisions that those people had is some believe you had to still be circumcised to be forgiven by God. Others said, no, you don't. So we would look at that, and I think the typical way a human being looks at that is there was a right and a wrong position. Wait a minute, Paul. If that's so, then what you should be saying is circumcision, when you obey it to God, doesn't profit you anything, but not being circumcised does profit you. Paul said, no. Why not? I mean, you're either right about something or you're wrong about it. Right? Correct? I either know the truth or I don't know it. I'm either right about this thing or I'm wrong about it. And whatever position it might be, whatever doctrine it might be, there's either a right and a wrong. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong. Paul said, no. You're both wrong. You're all wrong. Why? Read it. In Jesus Christ, neither circumcision profits you anything, nor uncircumcision, but faith which works by love. You see, what Paul is saying is, you've got to obey whatever law it is, whatever doctrine it is, you've got to obey the truth of it, not because it's right, but because you love God. I want to do whatever this thing is because I love Jesus. I love Him that much, so it doesn't matter what He's asked me to do. I want to do it, but I want to do it for Him. Not to be right. I want to obey because Jesus wants it. And I want to teach it to my brother because I want him to love the Lord and do what the Lord wants. Not because I want him to be right. That's what Paul is saying. In fact, notice how Paul goes on in verse 13. Brethren, you've been called unto liberty, unto freedom. Only use not your freedom for an occasion to the flesh. You see, what was happening is there were people who were teaching you were still under the yoke of Judaism, Moses' law. And some were saying you're free from that. They were right. The problem was they weren't just teaching you're free from the yoke of Judaism, so Jesus has done this for you. Love Jesus, do what Jesus says. They weren't teaching that. They were fighting over who was right. And that probably sounds familiar, doesn't it? We can look around the brotherhood. I've looked around it for 42 years, and that's what I've seen for 42 years. Now, that doesn't mean everybody. I want you to understand that. There are plenty of people who sincerely love Jesus and do what they do because they love Him. But there are plenty of people whose minds are consumed with being right and fighting with other people who are not. So Paul said it like this in verse 13. Don't use your freedom for an occasion to the flesh, but by love. Notice the word. Not teach, not show somebody. Serve one another. Notice verse 14. For all the law is fulfilled in one word or one saying, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But if you don't get that, and you bite and devour one another, what is he saying there? You snap at each other. You're right. I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. You're snapping and snapping and snapping. You just eat each other up. There is no group of people loving Jesus. Not anymore. You bite and devour, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. Because you know, you can fight about what's right. You can fight yourselves, disagree, and eat each other up right out of existence. Notice as Paul begged And I'm going to say it like that because that's literally the way the chapter starts. I beseech you, I beg you, brethren, let love, verse 10, verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. And then in verse 10, he just piles up these words for love. All three words, the only place in the Bible that all three New Testament words for love are used right in one place, are Romans 12, 9 and 10. Love each other. That is, have this active goodwill where you're always wanting to do for each other. Again, have brotherly love where you feel that affection. Again, even have family love for one another. All three terms piled up in verses 9 and 10. And then he comes back in chapter 13 and he says, owe no man anything, verse 8, but to love one another for this. And he begins to quote from the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You heard it read earlier. Don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie, etc. And if there's any other commandment that has to do with how we treat one another, it can be briefly comprehended. That word comprehended there is an interesting word because it literally means all these commandments will come through and slap you right in the head. And once it bombards you in the head, you will understand that what all of that together means is love your neighbor as yourself. Paul begged these Romans to do that. He begged the Ephesians. Turn to chapter 4 of Ephesians and he said, I beg you, brethren, that you walk worthy of the vocation. Only time that word is used in the New Testament. Here's your job as a Christian. What is my job? Endeavoring, laboring, working hard to do what? Keep the unity of the Spirit. Love your brother. The Corinthians needed to know that. They needed to know that was their job. Not to somehow get a spiritual gift that God didn't give to them, and not to fight with their brother because they didn't have it and all of that kind of thing. They needed to work hard at being unified. All of it coming together and working in the beautiful plan that God had for the church at Corinth. Paul urged the Philippians. He was in prison. He shouldn't have been there. It was wrong for him to be there. And he needed to be encouraged, consoled, and comforted. He needed to have some joy in his life, as any of us would in a situation like that. And Paul said, fulfill my joy. How can we do that, Paul? Love each other. It's really simple. If you'll be what you're supposed to be, and you'll love one another, and you'll build on that, I'll be ecstatic. My life was worth living. Finally, Paul directed the Thessalonians, this new church. They were so strong. What an example they were. He directed them. He said, you already love each other, but increase it more and more. You already love each other, he would say to them, but abound in it. Just wallow in how much you love each other. If you'll do that, man, what an example you will be. You know, I've gone to churches in different places, and no doubt you have too. And sometimes someone will begin to sort of brag on their congregation. I understand it. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. If you feel good about your church, then you want to tell people. But sometimes the first thing out of someone's mouth will be, we've got really faithful people here. Well, what do you mean? They come to church every time the doors are open, we have people. And some will point to a board like this and say, man, look at our numbers. Now, that's rare when the numbers are very consistent up and down. You know, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. But there are some churches, and people are very proud of that. And others will tell you we're, quote, unquote, doctrinally sound at this church. And that's great. Still others might tell you, as they brag on their church, of the chastity, the verity, as it were, the faithfulness morally wise of the congregation. These are good people and they are not sinful people. It is a very, very extremely rare thing where I have ever found someone to begin to brag on a congregation and the first thing out of their mouth is to say, we love each other. And I'm inclined to think, as I hear of all the good accomplishments of different churches, if you don't have love, you got nothing. And we don't have it here if we do not have love. Let's talk about the rule of love briefly, and I'll summarize as you read through 1 Corinthians 13. It is not hard. But let's listen to what Paul says. Verse 4. Paul said, love suffers long. You know what that means? Love is long-tempered. It's not short-tempered. Most people are short-tempered. You say something that aggravates me, angers me, you know, I'll let you know. But that's wrong, isn't it? No, love is long-tempered. It defers its anger. Love is kind. Well, it means to show yourself mild. And we all understand that. Not all the bullying strength, the charging, raging bull of strength that I can muster and that I have towards someone else about whatever. I'm right. I'm right. I'm right. I know I'm right. I'm going to let you know I'm right. And I'm going to tell you 400 reasons why I'm right. Love is kind. It shows itself mild. Love is not envious. These Corinthians needed that. It's not jealous. It doesn't look at someone else and want, you know, like eagerly driving after what my brother's got. Be thankful to God he's got it. Be thankful to God he's here with it. You know? Love is not envious. Love does not vaunt itself, the King James says. Well, that's a word that means boastful. It's a word for a braggart. Love is not a braggart telling you everything he has or is. Love does not vaunt itself. And love is not puffed up, which goes very much with that idea, but it means love is not swelled up with pride. That used to be one of the greatest problems I had, and that's the truth. I used to describe it like this. The first place I ever preached, oh man, I was 20 years old. I was preaching at a congregation in North Alabama with over 100 people. And mind you, most 20-year-olds didn't preach at a congregation with over 100 people. I used to describe it like this, and it was the truth. I could walk through the doors in the back of the building, and it felt like I just floated down to the front. I was better than Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk. That's true. And then God saw fit in His infinite mercy to knock me flat on my back a few times. You learn as you go through life. Not a lot to be proud. Not a lot of reason to be swelled up with pride. Love is not puffed up. Paul goes on in chapter 13 and verse 5. Love does not behave itself unseemly. Well, that means to act unbecomingly or unfittingly. Even dishonorable, even, and here's the idea literally from the term, it lacks proper form. In other words, when you look at a Christian, you should see a reflection of Jesus Christ. If you don't, he's out of character. That's not proper form for a Christian. Love doesn't seek its own. It's not driven by demanding something for itself. Whether that's a pat on the back, an agreement from somebody, saying to you, you're right and I'm wrong, whatever that is, love doesn't seek that. What love seeks is for us to show more love even so to Jesus. That's what love wants. Love is not easily provoked. It's not easily stirred up. It's not easily moved to anger. It sits back and looks at a situation from different sides. It's not rashly reacting to something, but it's rather considering. If somebody said something, why did they say it? Now, they may be totally wrong, but there may be some truth in that. You know, somebody walks up to you. Years ago, someone came up to me when I was about as overweight as I had ever been in my life, within a few pounds of it. And someone said to me, you're killing yourself. And it made me mad. Because of all the things that you might choose to say to me, of all the things that are right in my life that I've done right, etc., etc., you choose that. And then I stopped and thought about it for a minute. Physically, the shape I was in, it was very clear. You know something, Michael? That person's right. You're killing yourself. And then I went through that episode, as many of you know, where I said enough. That wasn't very long after. Love is not easily provoked. Love says, wait a minute, maybe I need to hear this. Maybe they didn't say it in the right way, but maybe I need to hear it. Love thinks no evil. This one to me is one of the hardest things to obey. Because what it literally means is, love doesn't keep a ledger or an account. You know, if you know somebody long enough, and a lot of us here, we've known each other for a long time. We can look around the room, and we could pull out the ledger in our mind and say, that person did this 12 years ago. I may not remember it's exactly 12 years, but I know they did it. Love doesn't keep that kind of account. It doesn't care for that. What difference does it make if somebody said something 15 years ago that hurt my feelings, and we should be long past that? Not the way they treat me now, but I can't let it go, is the idea. Love doesn't do that. Paul goes on to say in verse 6, love doesn't rejoice in iniquity. It doesn't favor or take delight in other people doing what's wrong, doing or thinking or feeling what's wrong. And here's the idea of, I feel good with numbers. As long as you're doing wrong and I'm doing wrong, we can both feel good about it. Love doesn't do that. No, love rejoices in the truth. It favors the truth. It takes delight in what is characteristic of the truth. And here's the idea. It's the idea of choosing to rejoice together with others in what is of the truth. As opposed to all of us enjoying, joining in together and being wrong. And finally, Paul would say in verse 7, and I love this quadrant of commands that Paul ends with. And I want you to think about it. Love bears all things. It holds up. It covers sometimes even with silence or concealing. Now, not sweeping things under the rug. We don't care if we're wrong or you're wrong. It's not that. But it is that I can bear it. I can hold up under it until we get to a better place. Love believes all things. It has faith in it. It trusts. It has confidence. My favorite passage in the Bible, and many of you know that, is Luke 7. Luke 7 and that woman. Jesus believed in her. It's amazing, isn't it? But he saw not a sinner at his feet like they saw. He saw what she could be. He saw the love, the devotion in her. That's what love does. It believes the best in someone. It hopes, it even expects the best from people. And they know it. You expect from me better, really, than I am. It anticipates that things are going to be better. Notice the point. To believe in somebody is present. To expect from somebody is future. I know you are going to overcome this. I know you are going to be better. And that's the picture I see. And finally, love endures all things. Because if you're going to believe that in the future someone is going to be at that place you see them being, then you're going to have to endure some things right now. And that kind of circles back to bearing all things. Because you see, what Paul is saying is, love never fails. It doesn't quit. It doesn't give up on the other person. It doesn't fall from a higher place to a lower. No, it just keeps getting higher and higher and higher. Love your neighbor as yourself. I ask this question as we close this morning, as I always do. Why do we assemble with a local church? Why are we here today? Three reasons are given in the New Testament for going to church. To assemble together with our brothers and sisters to worship God, yes. But to edify, to build each other up in the faith, and to encourage, to lift people up, and for us to do that with each other. That's why we meet. Have we accomplished that today? Love one another. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, but you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, we encourage you to confess that, to be willing to change your life, to repent, to be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. If you've done that, and you look at your life and you say, my life needs to be better, and I want to ask you to pray together with me, we'd love to do that. Won't you please come while Ed leads us in this song?